Hi, Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you are about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. The results from town meeting day are in, and Vermont Public reporters were there to cover it. A number of school budgets were voted down, due in large part to concerns over property tax increases. And the state's largest city, Burlington, has a new mayor, Emma Mulvaney-Stanek. She's the first woman to hold the position. We will continue to cover the impact of town meeting day over the next few days and weeks on Vermont Edition and Vermont Public, including on our show tomorrow, which is going to focus on those school budget votes. As we cover the 2024 elections, I want to remind you that Vermont Public is using a citizens' agenda approach, where we ask you, our listeners, to tell us what issues we should be covering. You can read more about the citizens' agenda and submit your questions at vermontpublic.org/election. Today, however, we are focusing on an institution that affects many, many Vermonters' lives, the University of Vermont Health Network. It serves about 1 million patients a year and employs around 15,000 people. It has more than a half dozen locations in both New York and Vermont, including the UVM Medical Center in Chittenden County, the Central Vermont Medical Center in Washington County, and Porter Medical Center in Addison County. Sunny Epen is the CEO of the UVM Health Network, and he joins us in studio today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I should also note that UVM Health Network is a Vermont Public business sponsor. Sunny, you've been in your position leading Vermont's largest health network for over a year now. You moved here from the Boston area. What motivated you to come to Vermont and take on this role?
Well, first of all, thanks again for having me. I have been here for a little more than a year. The motivating factor, I think, is the opportunity here in Vermont to be a model or a pilot for the entire country in the way that we manage care. We have the smallest population in the state, but if you even look at the northern New York area and even together about 1 million patients, is pretty small in the healthcare world of when you look at statewide healthcare. And the idea of being able to go to a population health management system where value and value-based care is the model is what's really exciting. And that's what motivated me to come out here, because I think we can really be a model for the country in the way that we deliver care.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with some recent news for the health network. Just a couple of weeks ago, UVM Health Network reached a major 11th hour deal with United Healthcare, the big national healthcare insurance company. And United had previously informed their insured that on March 1st, they would not be able to go see your physicians anymore without triggering higher rates. But this deal, this new deal, allows people covered by United to continue to receive that in-network care until spring of 2026. What was the sticking point, and what changed in the negotiations to have this deal go through at the last minute?
Well, these are always complicated, and we felt really bad for the patients that were involved. It wasn't a big insurer for us. It's 2,000-plus patients mm-hmm. here in Vermont and northern New York. But you know, every one of them, it's 100% of their impact. And so we understood that, first of all. So we're sympathetic and frustrated. We feel the frustration that the patients and their family members must have felt. Actually, they came back to us. We had been at the table the whole time, and we had been working through the issues and concerns. And the two biggest things, quite frankly, are the same things that we often have with private insurers, which is the rates. How much are you going to pay us? We sort of held firm on the idea that we needed to get the cost of living increases, the inflationary increases that we thought were fair and reasonable. And then the second part was around the sort of bureaucracy that surrounds a lot of the pre-authorization things that happen. So I think both of those, they actually came back to the table that we were sitting at the whole time, and we had really good, productive conversations at the end of the day, really putting the patients up in front of, for both of us, and saying, you know, what's really important and what we want to cover. And so we sort of stood firm on the idea as a not-for-profit that has been losing, you know, millions of dollars over the year, and for them on the for-profit side, making billions of dollars on the other side, and said, I think we thought that this was reasonable. And they came back and they also thought that it was reasonable. So at the end of the day, that's how we reached a compromise, I think.
Well, let's keep with the budget and finances talk for a moment here. The Green Mountain Care Board, the state's healthcare regulator, rejected UVM Medical Center's budget submission last fall and called for a budget cut. They said spending levels were unsustainable. That also happened with requests for higher charges for multiple locations in the UVM health network. What has happened since that decision came out, and how do you think that that decision from the Green Mountain Care Board, which can sound very kind of like high level and confusing for folks to follow, myself included, how does it affect patients day to day?
Yeah, so they cut about $75 million from our approved budget, the budget that was approved by our board and that we brought forward. If you're an individual patient, it can feel like, what does that mean? Just like what you're saying, because we look at it largely on a global scale of what is the impact that has to us. So, you know, the real impact it had to us was that we had to do a number of things to make sure that our budget then came back in line. And that meant we had to cut some programs and some projects and some people. And so we cut about 130 open positions, which does have impact because every one of those roles plays some impact in the way that they deliver care or they support other employees. So that was the real impact of what we had to do. You know, and it's always a fine line that we're walking about balancing our budget, making sure that there is a margin. We really need that margin because we have to reinvest in our communities and our patients. And so the impacts will be subtle. So if you're an individual patient, you might come in and notice that, oh, wow, that elevator is down today. I wonder what's going on with that. Or I thought we were going to have a particular surgical robot and we're going to delay that for 6 months. And so, you know, you might see that. Maybe the waits for access might get a little bit slower instead of getting a little bit faster in a particular area. Those are the decisions you have to make.
Does it also mean that patients might be paying a little bit less for care?
You know, it's really an interesting point. I would say the insurance companies set the rates by and large. And so those insurance rates were set ahead of time. And so in reality, they probably won't see a difference in this year's budget and what they're going to do, because those rates got set before our budget got set. So it's really about how are we going to utilize the money that is coming in or not utilize it to meet those same demands, if you can imagine that. Mm. Yeah.
So eliminating around 130 vacant positions, what types of positions were these?
Yeah, so they were scattered all around. We worked really hard of not eliminating direct patient contact positions. So these were going to be support services positions. So everything you could imagine from maybe a couple of environmental services positions went away, maybe a couple of billing cycle positions went away, maybe a couple of the pre-authorization positions went away, other things that, you know, we would do work on. Maybe instead of 100 people answering phones, there's 95 people answering phones. So all of those, you can imagine all of those sort of, there'd be a little bit further away from the direct patient side of the care. Mm.
Well, speaking of phones, our phone lines are open. If you have a question for the CEO of the UVM Health Network or want to share your experience with receiving care at one of its facilities, give us a call. Now is your time. 800-639-2211 is our number. So you've had to eliminate these positions, but meanwhile, you and, you know, healthcare networks across the country are facing a shortage of qualified healthcare workers. What are the main challenges to recruitment? Let's go through a couple of them and how you're addressing them.
Yeah. So I just want to take one step back. It wasn't just eliminating the positions, right? So we've also looked at all of our shared services and said, how can we cut expenses in the work that we're doing there? Mm-hmm. It's a combination of all of those factors, not just the cutting the positions there.
Thank you.
There's many factors that have led to where we are on the healthcare side of in the whole country and in Vermont. That the reality is that there is a shortage of healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, and every other employer group that we have to look at, whether it's respiratory therapists, environmental services, food service workers. The competition for those workers have also gone up. So That means that prices have gone up for what we need to pay to get them to come into the marketplace, and that we've had to hire travelers to cover that in the interim space. All of that, of course, drives up costs. The inflationary pressures that impacted every one of us, from the groceries that you see to gas prices, also impacted us, particularly on the pharmaceutical side and on device sides, like if you have to buy a OR device or a particular kind of speculum. All of those things have also gone up. So the prices for all of those items have gone up. And then the everyday things, we have to buy food as well for the cafeteria. All of those prices have gone up. So all of that together has led to where we are, where we find ourselves today. So the recruitment piece, I would say that before I got here, when I looked at where Boston was and where Vermont was, there was a little bit of a discount, quite frankly. You could hire a doctor for 10-15% less because people love to live in Vermont, and they were willing to take that pay cut because they thought the environment was great, housing was a little less expensive, and they wanted to do that. We've lost that now. Because of the shortage in both doctors and nurses, that recruitment, we're not anymore at that discounted rate. Housing prices are really high. Childcare is hard to find. Houses are hard to find, even if the prices are high. And the marketplace is so great that it's not 10-15%. It was 25%. And people are saying, oh, I'm willing to go live in Boston and make 25% more now. And so we've had to actually pay higher than that to attract people to come live in a more rural area and still pay really high prices for housing if they can find it and food, et cetera. So that's the really big challenge for us. Doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, you can name it.
I have more questions for you about that housing element, but let's go to the phones. Let's go to Seth in South Burlington. Seth, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for answering my call. I'm wondering when the medical center is considering cutting positions, whether the level of administrative compensation, including the CEOs, for example, is considered as a possible way of mitigating those layoffs. Thank you.
Thank you, Seth.
Yeah, so we look at everything, and sort of if we look at our administrative roles as well, those are also cut in that same percentage. So every one of those matter. When we look at CEO or executive level compensation, we've got a compensation committee that's made up of our board members and outside public volunteers who actually hold us to a pretty high standard. We pay at the 50th percentile. It's quite frankly, it's been challenging for us to recruit when we say that this is the pay price that we
50th percentile of what?
Of comparable medical centers across the Northeast. When we look at that and we're trying to attract people to come and work here because we want really good people for our patients and our communities, that's a challenge. That is what we pay. So we pay at that level. We try to pay at that level as much as possible. And then when we look at total administrative costs, as you look at the percentage of our people, it's quite low, actually. It's in the 10% of our overall employee costs. So even if you were to like cut that in half, it still wouldn't make up for the budget of the declines that we're looking at that we need to cut. So we need to cut across the board, and we've done that. But every one of those roles also has a important function that they play. So.
Well, let's get to that topic of housing for a moment here, and then we do need to take one short break. So you are not just the CEO of the health network, but you're kind of in the business of real estate now. Can you tell us a little bit about what the UVM Health Network is doing to try to address the statewide housing shortage?
Sure. So we've partnered with some developers to actually build housing for employees. We've opened up 60 apartment units in South Burlington, actually. We did that last year. We were going to open up another 120 this summer. We're going to have childcare in that unit for maybe 50 to 75 folks. It is important. I mean, it's already oversubscribed. We've got a long waiting list, even for the units that haven't even opened up yet. But it's really a drop in the bucket. It sort of speaks to the issue that we really need to have housing all across Vermont and in Burlington for not just our business, but for all businesses. So, but we're doing our part, and we're going to continue to do that. We're looking both at for the Central Vermont site. We're looking in up northern New York and in Burlington again to continue to do this because our employees need it. And so we're partnering with local developers to continue to do that.
Mm. Now, Sunny, before the break, you brought up traveling nurses. I'm curious if the amount of money that your organization spends on bringing out-of-state nurses into Vermont has gone down since, you know, it kind of reached a height during the pandemic and in the year directly following.
Yeah. So the price per hour, and it's not just even nurses, it's nurses, it's LNAs, it's all sorts of folks that work in that care, has dropped dramatically, has dropped by more than a half from its peak. So yes, the prices have definitely gone down. Our numbers have also gone down. It feels like nurses and others are going back home, essentially, not necessarily coming back home to Vermont, but going back home to their other areas, and that's brought the price down. And the numbers are going down as we're recruiting and retaining more. So that is working.
Mm. Do you feel like the efforts that have been going on at UVM and elsewhere to get more nurses into like the educational pipeline to become nurses, to be certified, is that starting to have an effect?
So I think the work that we were doing prior to COVID has continued to have an impact, and that's been really important. And we're totally committed to that, both here at the University of Vermont with the nursing program and the health sciences program, the medical school program. We're totally invested in that, and we've just doubled down in our work of trying to recruit and retain those folks early on to come become residents, come become young nurses, and then stay with us. So that's been going on. But we've greatly been expanding that with our community colleges, both here in Vermont and in Northern New York, of partnering with them to take our existing employees and employees in our community that wouldn't have otherwise thought that they had the opportunities to be in working in a medical career, recruiting them and then giving them the opportunity while they're working to go to school. So we're paying for their salary while they're working to allow them to go to school, give them the time to do that so that we're investing in them. And hopefully they're going to come back and stay with us. So that is going to pay off, I think. It's just starting. Some of the programs are short, some of them are longer, but we're really committing to doing that and have been recruiting folks to do that. And it's working really well. That's been a great addition. And I think we'll see the fruits of that this year and in the coming years. So.
Mm. Well, let's pivot for a moment here to the experiences that patients have when they come in to one of the facilities that you run. And I'll start with wait times, because I know it's an issue, at least anecdotally, that we hear a lot about these days. Just as a personal example, a colleague of mine had to take his child to the ER in Burlington a few weeks ago. They waited 5 hours to see a doctor. Again, that's one person's experience, but I bet many of our listeners have had a similar one. Do you have data available on the average wait times in your ERs, and what are you doing to make them shorter?
Yeah, sure. So this is totally a complete challenge, and I appreciate that the individual times can be horrible. On average, we're about 30 minutes across our network. Of course, you can imagine all the factors that play into that, right? The obvious one is acuity. If you come in and you need to be seen urgently or emergently, you'll get seen in minutes. If you come in and you get triaged out to something that's not so urgent, you're going to wait. But it also depends on the time of day, the day of week, how busy they are in that particular area. So if you're coming in for pediatrics in particular, and there's a long wait time for pediatrics on that particular time, yes, it doesn't surprise me that you could wait 3 or 4 hours. I guess I want to say a couple things. There's many factors that deal with that. Number one, let me just start with this saying, if you need to come to the emergency room, you should come to the emergency room because we want to take care of you and we want to serve our patients there if that's what they need to do. But the things that are holding us back are that there are many patients waiting in the emergency room to get admitted. Mm-hmm. They're waiting to get admitted because there's many patients in our hospital at any given time, 80 to 100 across our hospitals, who don't need to be in the hospital, but they have no place else to go because the nursing homes or the acute care, post-acute programs aren't ready to take them because they've had staffing issues or they've closed down. We've probably had 500 beds closed down across Vermont and Northern New York for our post-acute. So those patients are sitting in the hospital waiting to go home or go out to another place. Even going home and getting support at home has been difficult. The visiting nurses, their numbers are also down. So that backlog backs up into the emergency room. So those get crowded and the waits get longer, right? So all of those factors are playing into that right now.
Mm. What do you do about that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that we are trying to do. So one is that we are trying to decrease our length of stay, being more and more assertive on doing that work right up front. When you come in, we say, oh, we expect you're going to be in the hospital for 3 days. We're not waiting for 3 days to happen and then let you know that we're doing it. So we're starting the planning earlier, and that is having some impact. We're seeing our length of stay go down. We're also, you know, we have within the system about 450 post-acute beds that we actually control. Those are very expensive to run, and we don't get reimbursed well for that. But what we've done is we've maximally opened them, even though that's an area that we are really staffing with travelers, and we've continued to do that. But we're opening those up so that we can move those patients out of the University of Vermont Medical Center or Central Vermont so that we can take care of more acutely ill patients. That all of that helps us with moving the patients from the emergency room into the beds that they need to be in at any given time, and that helps us alleviate that. The other part that's a longer-term commitment, but that we're committed to, is how do we manage our primary care services so that those are being taken care of, so that those kinds of problems are being taken care of ahead of time. That's where the value-based care, population health management, you know, really good follow-up with patients, really good the ability to be able to respond when someone calls and needs an appointment, will keep them from coming into the emergency room, will keep them from coming and getting admitted. That's the work we have to do upstream, and that's part of that value-based care proposal and proposition that we want to take on. So there's a lot of things happening to do that. They're slow. They're expensive. The reimbursement system doesn't actually reward that kind of behavior, but that's what we want to do, and that's what we want our state to do.
Why not? Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, so let's say that you are calling your patients ahead of time and proactively reaching out to your 85-year-old patients, just as an arbitrary thing, who have congestive heart failure. Yeah. You're calling them every week to check in on them. That takes time and effort, and they may have some issues that you want to deal with. There's no reimbursement for that. It may keep them from coming both to your office. It may keep them from coming to the hospital or the emergency room. But our system today does not reimburse for those kinds of behaviors. That's where we want to change, right? That's where the opportunity is to move to a value-based care system where you say, you get X dollars for taking care of that patient. It doesn't matter if you have to treat them in the hospital, treat them in the emergency room, or treat them at home. And so you push that care upstream because we think it's the right thing to do to keep people healthy. But right now, our system doesn't reward that behavior.
Hmm. So what role does telemedicine play in all of this?
Sure.
Both with reducing wait times to see a physician and also, increasing that kind of comprehensive care that you're talking about.
So one of the really positive things that came out of the pandemic was that our adoption of virtual care skyrocketed. And we're still sitting now from probably less than 1% at about 20%. Certain specialties have adopted it much more. Something like behavioral health has loved it. It's been great because you know, once you know the patient, you can actually see them and talk to them, and you can get a lot of care done that way. The other way that we've used sort of digital health, I'd say more globally, is using it for our internal consults. And so we started a pilot program about 2021 where we said, if you need a consult, I wonder if we can do it with a communication from our primary care doc to the specialist and if they can get that question answered. That was very successful in a pilot, and this year we're hoping to do about 4,000 of those.
So instead of you going to see the specialist yourself, you would talk to your primary care and they would kind of reach out to the specialist on the side and get you the information you need?
That's exactly right. Okay. So typically, the way you do it is you go see your primary care doc, and then they would send you to a nephrologist because they had some questions that needed to answer. Instead, what we're doing is that the primary care doc is taking all the information and sending it to that specialist to look at and then respond directly back to the primary care physician. What it does is it keeps the slots open for people that really need to see that specialist, gets the answer back to the primary care doc probably about 75% of the time or greater, and it prevents that patient from needing to make another appointment, go out to that specialist, get an answer, and then come back. Mm. So it's really saving us time. But I'll tell you again, the system doesn't reward that, right? So it's extra work for that primary care doc, extra work for the specialist with no greater reimbursement coming into the system. Mm. It's better for our patients. It's better for our community. That's the way we should do it. But it's just an interesting dichotomy there. And we're doing that. That's making a big difference. The other part that we're going to open up that's going to make a difference is the electronic scheduling for patients. Mm-hmm. And so that patients can actually schedule on their own using an app, ideally, or using your computer. Just like you could schedule dinner, you can schedule your appointment. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes work that has to happen for that. We're opening that up for primary care this year. But what it'll allow you to do is you'll be able to look yourself and say, oh, you know what? I can drive 10 minutes further, but I can get my appointment 2 weeks earlier. Is it worth it for me to do that? That opportunity is going to be opened up as well. So that we're using digital in both of those areas right now.
Exciting stuff. We're speaking with the head of the UVM Health Network, Sunny Epen. Sunny, we've gotten a number of questions in for you, so let's go through some of those. Kevin in Burlington called in. The line dropped, but we did get Kevin's question. He's a medical provider in the area and wants to know your plan on providing more inpatient psychiatric care.
Kevin, thanks for your question. You ask it because you know how complicated it is. We have a plan because we know we need to have more inpatient psychiatric beds, both for adults and for kids, to do that. It's going to cost quite a bit of money to do it. There's two pieces to it. One is the just initial, like, do we need a bigger building? And we do. We need probably approximately 25 more inpatient beds for adults to be able to do that. So we have to figure out the money to pay for that. But more importantly is the ongoing cost, because inpatient psychiatric care costs a lot of money and it doesn't get reimbursed. And so we don't know exactly where the state is going to come through on helping us with that. Do they want it to be our responsibility as the University of Vermont Health Network, or is it going to be a statewide responsibility to take that on? Mm-hmm. So we're still waiting on that. We have plans. We know what we need to do. We know how much it's going to cost. I don't know how we're going to get there to the expense. The state's got to – as a state, have to make a decision, do we want to pay for this or not?
Well, speaking of those rates and how they trickle down to patients, we received an email from a listener named Nate, who says that they and their wife are researching the costs for local monitoring as we are planning for an out-of-state IVF cycle. UVM Health Network charges a retail rate of about $1,600 for transvaginal ultrasounds. The negotiated rate with insurance providers for that procedure is about $1,100. These rates are respectively 5 and 3 times the national average rate for this procedure. Why is UVM Health Network unable to offer this procedure at anywhere near a competitive rate? Nate asks.
So the rate setting is complicated, and it's complicated for a variety of reasons. So number one is that there are some things that, first of all, the rate that is set is rarely the one that's paid. So there's like sort of the public rate, but then the insurance companies are negotiating that rate down. Mm. And there's a typical rate for that. If you have to pay out of pocket for that, so you're saying, I'm not going to use my insurance to do it, I'm going to pay it myself to do that. Why is that rate so high? The rates are high because we balance those rates and collect the dollars for that, often in order to pay for things that don't get reimbursed well, so like mental health. Mm. And so that's the rationale for it. The other part is that rates that are set by for-profit ambulatory centers that just focus on that are quite different than the rates that we set at the University of Vermont, where we have to take care of everyone that comes in. And so if I can just pick a small slice of healthcare and just focus on that and just take care of people who have the ability to pay and do their routine things for otherwise healthy people, I can sort of, I would call it, cherry pick those out, and I can make a lot of money on that. But when we're called, as our mission is, to take care of everyone without regard to their ability to pay, you wind up slicing and dicing that a little bit differently, mm-hmm. to be able to provide that care for everyone.
Well, we have just a couple minutes left with you, Sunny. I want to make sure that we get in one more caller from Todd in St. Johnsbury. Todd, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. Just two things. One, I worked at the UVM Medical Center for about 35 years and also worked at Dartmouth University of Minnesota, and UVM really stands out. Its heart is in the right place, despite problems everybody has. And the other thing I wanted to say was a family member has a chronic pain issue and took advantage of the chronic pain program at UVMMC, and it's probably one of the best, if not the best ones in the country. Everyone she interacted with was outstanding. So people with chronic pain, that's a resource that's really valuable. So I just wanted to shout those things out.
Well, Todd, thank you so much for calling in and sharing those experiences with us. What are your thoughts here in Todd's call?
Todd, thanks, first of all, for working with us for 35 years. It's that kind of dedication we have from so many of our employees that makes us great. The Pain Center is a really unique, fantastic program that we have here. It's become a model for pain centers across the country in the way that it's an integrated pain model of being able to take care of patients from multiple components. And we've been able to show that, number one, that their activities of daily living are much improved. They're happier. Their utilization of opioids and other pain medication goes down. Their ER visits and radiology visits go down as well. So it's really a success for us. We just can't scale it up as quickly as we'd like to be able to do it. But thanks for calling attention to it, Todd.
Thank you, Todd. And Sunny, you've been the CEO of the University of Vermont Health Network. Thank you so much for your time. It was great to get to know you a bit better.
Kayla, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. I'd love to come back anytime.
All right, we'll do it. If you have been one of the many unlucky folks to contract norovirus, you know what a miserable time it is. Cases of this highly infectious stomach bug are on the rise. Here to discuss what it is and how to avoid it is Dr. Tim Leahy, an infectious disease physician at UVM and the director of medical ethics there. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Leahy.
Hi, Michaela.
And listeners, if you have questions about the bugs that you and your family seem to be catching, you can give us a call at 800-639-2211. Dr. Leahy, let's start with the basics of norovirus. What are the symptoms? What should people be looking out for?
So norovirus is a nasty virus that makes people have acute onset vomiting. You can go from feeling completely normal 1 second to 2 hours later, you can't get away from the toilet. Most people also have a fever, and diarrhea can happen. And usually this lasts for a day or two, and then you're back to normal, wishing you could just forget that whole experience.
Yes, I've been there. It's rough. How do you know if it's the norovirus or some other stomach bug?
It's a great question. And, you know, in most cases, we actually don't run diagnostic testing because the syndrome is so distinctive. That story of super quick onset of vomiting that goes away pretty quickly is just characteristic of norovirus. It turns out there are a couple of other viruses that can do similar things, but at the end of the day, it probably does not matter what the name of the virus is. You got to stay hydrated and try to nap and forget about the whole thing as soon as you possibly can.
Cases of norovirus are on a rise right now, right? What are we seeing in Vermont?
You know, every winter, usually in January through March, we see peaks of norovirus around the country, especially in the Northeast. And so this year is like all the others. And, since we don't do testing, we don't have we don't do testing very frequently. We don't have super precise numbers on, where we are in the peak of it. But if you look nationally, it looks like we've passed the peak. If you look in the Northeast, it looks like we are at it. So I'm hoping that means that the week or two ahead are going to bring some relief to Vermonters.
Hmm. So I'm curious if there are groups of people who need to be more careful about avoiding situations in which they might contract the norovirus. I mean, we've been talking about it as a very yucky 24 hours that you have to go through. But I can imagine for some individuals, it's not just gross 24 hours. It can actually be dangerous.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the people who are most likely to contract norovirus usually can handle it fine. You know, it's folks living in congregational settings or working in congregational settings, so college students and military barracks, and these are typically healthy people who can deal with the misery and get back to life as normal. But older individuals who might be a little bit more prone to the downsides of dehydration need to pay special attention to staying hydrated and to seek care if that's not possible. And then immune-compromised people sometimes can get unusual manifestations of norovirus and need to take special measures to stay away from people who are vomiting or have recently had norovirus.
Mm. And if you do get it, what should you do? Should you go to a doctor? Should you take anything? Should you just lay low?
you know, honestly, if you're doing okay and basically just are miserable but can stay hydrated and can sleep it off, it's probably better to stay away from other people and just kind of endure the misery without spreading it. Of course, as Dr. Ethan said, if you're unstable and really need extra support, if the dehydration is too much to fix at home, that's when you should come in to get seen. But honestly, most people don't need to do that. What is important for everybody to do is to use good hand hygiene. We realized in the COVID pandemic that we were overemphasizing hand hygiene, that it was about the air. But for norovirus, it's all about washing your hands and your bathroom so that the next person near you or in that space doesn't pick it up.
Hmm. Well, listeners, we are speaking right now with Dr. Tim Leahy, an infectious disease physician at the University of Vermont. If you have questions about norovirus or the other diseases that are going around right now, give us a call, 800-639-2211. Dr. Leahy, tell us a bit more about flu season. I remember at the start of the flu season, kind of in late fall, people were kind of bracing for another very intense year, particularly following the last few coming out of the pandemic, where you know, people were catching everything. How has this year been shaping up?
You know, this year has been a mixed bag. There's been bad news and good news. It's been a fairly ordinary year for influenza and RSV, and we are hopeful that the edge of both has been taken off by vaccines, a new vaccine in the case of RSV that we couldn't have used before. And then for COVID, it's been sort of, you know, a real mix, where we had vigorous transmission of COVID. Case numbers were through the roof around the country. Wastewater numbers were super high. And yet the good news was that while hospitalization and death rates did rise, particularly in vulnerable Vermonters and others, they did not rise nearly as high as the previous major surges of the pandemic, making us think that we're really seeing strong proof that immunity is working and making the worst of it not happen.
For somebody who hasn't gotten the flu shot yet, is it too late?
No, it's not too late. You know, there is still flu transmission happening during the colder months. And so, yeah, if I realize, oh, crap, I forgot, I'd probably go out and get it.
All right. Well, let's turn for a moment here to COVID. I saw that the CDC recently dropped the 5-day isolation guideline for it. As an infectious disease doctor, what was your response seeing that change in guidelines?
Yeah, that really has generated a lot of controversy, and I think that there are good reasons for some critiques, but also I think some of the critique has been overblown. So I can kind of go through what the key message is and where there's consensus and where there's some dispute. So they've decided that in response to that lower death rate, lower hospitalization rate, that some adjustment in isolation precautions for people who have COVID are reasonable. And what they suggest is that if you have a fever, you stay home. And if your symptoms are still strong and haven't yet improved, then you stay home. But once your fever is gone and your symptoms are improving, then it's okay to leave isolation as long as you wear a mask for 5 days around other people, and you try as best as you can to try to stay away from others, to open the window, to meet outside if you can, all the usual stuff we're used to. That's certainly a shorter duration of isolation than has been recommended previously. Usually we say 9 or 10 days after symptoms start. If you add that up, since most people have symptoms for a few days, and then they have another day of waiting, and then you add 5 days with a mask, that actually leads, studies have shown, to very little extra transmission compared to if you just isolate for 10 days. Mm. And so the CDC made that change because of the reality that most employees cannot afford to stay home from work for 10 days. Yeah. That, you know, I am lucky and I can make that choice because UVM Medical Center supports me to do that, but many people just cannot stay home, and they take the hit in their wallet. So the CDC said, hey, we would love for there to be better leave policies, such as are present in many European countries, but we have to make guidelines for reality and not reality as we wish it was. Hmm. So the fact that you should wear masks around others while likely contagious in a way that will reduce the chance of transmission, totally consensus. Is it okay to shorten that duration? That's been the subject of some debate, and I think that's good. I'm glad we debate these things, but I want to make sure that it's professional debate, that people realize that the dweebs in public health, the underfunded, underrespected dweebs in public health, are doing the best they can with things that are not in their control, and we can treat them with respect while we debate those things.
Are you seeing the tenor of that debate kind of turn downwards? Is this concern coming from something specific that's happened? I certainly remember the very intense debates over COVID policies that happened, a couple years back. Does that seem to be reappearing?
I think in our general civic dialogue, we're struggling with how to have productive debate without demonizing the other. That's a problem across the board, and medicine is no exception. And I would say that there are reasons for people to feel upset. For instance, there are people who know that long COVID and other manifestations of COVID are a big deal and have not slowed down and need to be recognized. And I think maybe they feel like their voices are not being heard. And so that can lead to anger and rejection of these things. And I'd say I've seen on social media demonization of the CDC leadership. And I would just say, hey, that's a valid point to put forward. We should talk about that stuff. But also we want to make sure we get the main message across. Stay home until your symptoms are improving and your fever is gone. Wear a mask around other people for 5 days. And then debate some of the details around the edges, but not lose sight of that main message.
Well, Dr. Lee, I find it really interesting that the CDC has changed these COVID guidelines. It sounds like in large part to acknowledge the reality of what it means to be a member of the workforce in the United States. Like this change, as you're describing it, didn't come just because, the CDC says, yeah, it's safe to only isolate for 5 days now. It's really because they're acknowledging that people can't afford to stay home for longer than that. It's very interesting.
Yeah, that is right. It's sort of a lesson that we've learned in many infectious diseases, including HIV. An example is that once upon a time, the recommendation for HIV transmission prevention was just say no, just have no sex. But we realized that was just not feasible. It wasn't appropriate to the context of people's lives. That's what the CDC is doing here, is trying to make guidelines that fit what real employees face in their real lives, even though they wish it would be better than it really is.
And have we seen any changes in the fatality rates with COVID recently? Have those gone up or down?
Yeah, this is a really key piece, and it's a big rationale for this guideline. It turns out that while we've had as many cases as in previous surges in the pandemic, the hospitalization and death rates are far, far lower. It's great news. And these guidelines respond to the fact that when there's less risk, maybe we can take fewer risk precautions. But we need to not forget that death and hospitalizations are not the only things we care about. And so there'll be some natural, good, healthy debate about how to prevent those downsides, too.
Well, fascinating stuff. Dr. Tim Leahy, thank you so much for joining us, talking us through norovirus, COVID, all the rest.
Always a pleasure. The world keeps on giving us contagion.
Dr. Tim Leahy is an infectious disease physician at the University of Vermont and the Director of Medical Ethics at UVMMC.